Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Namwali Sirpel, author of The Old Drift, her first novel, published in March by Hogarth. Namwali has won many prizes in literature. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, McSweeney's, The Guardian, and in numerous short story anthologies, including my favorite, Best American Short Stories. Oh, and her first book of literary criticism, Seven Modes of Uncertainty, was published in 2014 by Harvard. We may come back to that later, too. So welcome, Namwali, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I always worry when I pick up a book and I see a family tree. I get scared that I'll be flipping back and forth through the whole book. But you didn't really have to do that here. Mm-hmm. And once you get into it, you kind of know where you are, even though it is as expansive as, say, Cloud Atlas or something like that. So was that part of the hard work of this novel, was keeping the reader engaged with each character as you went from one to the other?
I think figuring out the amount of time we would spend with each character was key to that for me. You know, there's, you mentioned Seven Modes of Uncertainty, and one of my chapters talks about three different texts called Seven Modes of Uncertainty, a short story by Shirley Jackson, three texts called Seven Types of Ambiguity. So a short story by Shirley Jackson, a book by William Empson, and a novel by Elliot Perlman. And I did a lot of research on why seven. And there were various numerological and mystical things, but one factotum that I found was that that's about the limit of human memory to why phone numbers are seven numbers, apart from the area code. And so there was a point where I realized, you know, the best novels keep their number of perspectives to seven or less, seven or fewer, because it's very hard actually to keep everyone in mind. And you know, I ended up with 9, 10 if you count Percy, who starts the book. And part of my feeling about it was I wanted to give this sense of something that just exceeds the limit, that just exceeds the possibility of grasping it all in one go, because that excess is very much part of what I was trying to get at. But I did want everyone in the novel who I spend time with to feel real to the reader. My favorite part of writing it was bringing characters back that you had seen a long time ago, even in a minor character form, and how they intersect with people in future generations and also in other genres. That was also of interest to me. So I think that, you know, figuring out the length of time was a big deal for me, but also figuring out the number of people was a big deal for me.
Well, let's talk about, you know, like looking for the source of a river. And so let's talk about the beginning. It's not even Percy, it's Dr. Livingstone.
Yes.
So why don't you just talk a little bit about the coincidental thing that kind of gives rise to the whole book, if you'd like to.
Yeah, so David Livingstone, Scottish explorer and doctor and missionary, is quite revered still in Zambia because he died in what is now Zambia. And he also, you know, is famously credited for having, quote-unquote, discovered Victoria Falls. So I begin the novel with this supposed discovery, and I talk about the fact that Dr. Livingstone named the falls after his queen, which was actually uncharacteristic of him. He didn't do that very often. And the fact that the bearers with him and the people he met in that part of the world called it Mosiotunya, which is the smoke that thunders. And he found it essentially when he was on this kind of Sisyphean quest to find the source of the Nile. And he hunted around, and for years and years, he was sick with fever. When Stanley found him and said, "Dr. Livingston, I presume," and shook his hand, he offered to bring him back to England, and Livingston refused. He wanted to find the source of his Nile. This was a kind of weirdly Ahab-like quest for him. And in the end, it turns out that the source of the Nile is nowhere near Zambia. There are two sources, because there's the Blue Nile and the White Nile, and their sources are nowhere near here. But because Livingston kind of made this initial plunge into, you know, what was then a kind of unexplored territory for white foreigners, more and more people came. And this one of the seven natural wonders of the world, it, you know, became a site of attraction, really, for people from all over the world to come and see it, and to settle the land, and to draw borders, which shifted many, many times over many, many years. So I start the book with this kind of account of Livingston's quixotic journey to find the source of the Nile, which turns out not to have been there at all, as the kind of inciting incident for the colonial path that led to the colonization of northern Rhodesia, which eventually became Zambia.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about this before the show began, and so it's the epigraph, and like I said, I find epigraphs to be very telling, especially when it's as long as this one, because it's kind of like the cover of a jigsaw box, and you kind of get an idea of what might be inside. So, one, it was a long section, but the question I had is, why did you choose, and there's other allusions in the book too, why did you choose the Western canon to begin a book about Zambia? I mean,
it just... So Zambia is a fabrication of the West. So, you know, there are other countries in Africa that had kingdoms. You know, the Great Zimbabwe is the ruins of a former kingdom. The Buganda was a kingdom before it became Uganda. Egypt, obviously. There are other parts of Africa that had this history of going back to a consolidated form as a kingdom. But my country was a set of seven major tribes that were lassoed together by various colonial interests. The Portuguese, the English, at a certain point, you know, southern Rhodesia, the Boers coming up from South Africa, the history of my country is kind of this kind of compression from all sides, because we're surrounded, we're landlocked by other countries, and we were carved up in the scramble for Africa, and we were at one point, those borders were dissolved, and we were part of the federation with Nyasaland and southern Rhodesia, now Malawi and Zimbabwe, and then we reconsolidated into what is now Zambia. The arbitrariness of this is evident to me by the fact that the upper left corner of Zambia is a right angle, which is unusual. The rest of it is quite riverine. But that border was drawn by the Italian king because the Portuguese and the British couldn't decide. So a man took a pen and drew, you know, two lines, and that's my country. So it felt important to me to capture the contingency of that and to not give credence to the notion that there was a kingdom there that was conquered, because that's not actually how colonialism happened. As for engaging with the Western canon, well, you know, I engage with the Zambian canon as well, but it's harder to see because you don't know it. So I'm engaging with stories and even with novels from my country, and with, you know, folk tales that I grew up with, stories that my mother told me about her family. So there are different canons that I think will light up for different readers as you read the book.
As we go back to the beginning, when we're talking about Dr. Livingston, why don't you tell the story about Percy and the hotelier and that, because that really sets the stage.
Yeah, sure. So The first chapter following this introduction to the nation, which is told in these, in one of many interstitial kind of interludes narrated by a swarm of mosquitoes, I plunge into the novel by discussing a man who pitched up at what is now what was called the Old Drift in the late 19th century to try to make his fortunes. He was a working class British photographer who grew up in Cambridgeshire and was kicked out of the chemistry lab at Trinity and then came to Africa and made his way up to the Falls. And I based his entire chapter on a book called The Autobiography of an Old Drifter. So Percy's a historical figure. And I found in his description of this place on the banks of the Zambezi, so a drift is the narrowest and stillest part of a river where you can drift things across. And so a little outpost sprung up on the banks there. And he describes it almost like the Old West. It's like this old pioneer town. These settlers from all over the world, from Germany. There was a barman from Chicago, and there was an Italian hotelier named Pietro Gavuzzi, who had come to set up the first Victoria Falls Hotel. And so Percy describes Pietro in some detail. He also mentions a man named Ngulube, who Percy misspells his name in the autobiography. He says he's Ngulubu, but his name is actually Ngulube. And he tells the story of accidentally shooting this local man. And the joke is that the name means pig, and Percy had mistaken him for a wild pig in the bush. So it's this kind of horrific moment in the autobiography. And it also gave me this figure. This is how, when you're looking at the history books often, or when you're looking at, you know, who got to write and print their story, you see glimpses of actual people. And so I didn't give Ngulube much life, but I did follow the path that I kind of concocted for his daughter and his granddaughter and her, you know, that lineage. So these three families, Percy's family, the Italian family, with the patriarch of Pietro Gavuzzi, and Ngulube's family, get caught up in a cycle of unwitting retribution that kind of spirals over generations and time as the novel proceeds. So it goes from the late 19th century, the early 20th century, all the way to a near future Zambia, just tracking these three families and how they intersect and collide over time.
Well, if we follow that from the beginning, then if we follow that from the grandmothers, and everybody's favorite character, at least, is Sibylla.
Oh, that's not true, actually.
Well,
thank you.
Well, it's just that
one
she's...
One of my favorite things about this book is that everyone has a different favorite character.
For me, and for some of the reviewers, I would say that. But, so, Sibylla is where I first realized, and sometimes when I say this to authors, they get upset. It was when I first realized that there was this element of magical realism, and then when I've listened to some of your interviews, that as soon as I read about her, I thought of Marquez and Borges, and then in your interviews, you kind of validate that. So why don't you talk a little bit about Sibylla and her strange characteristics, unusual characteristics.
So Pietro's granddaughter is Sibylla, who grows up not knowing, you know, her who her father was, and who her grandfather was, and she is born covered with hair that grows continually. So it's no matter how often or avidly she trims her hair, she is constantly covered with this kind of flow, these flowing locks that spill out from her body. And this, you know, she is the first of the three grandmothers, all three of whom have kind of magical realist traits to them.
True.
And I think, yes, Marquez was definitely an inspiration. There's a short story of his that involves opening up a casket and a young girl inside who died. It's, her hair is still has still continued to grow after her death, as have her fingernails. I remember being really struck by that. I was also inspired by Maria Luisa Bombal, who's a Chilean writer, who's Borges called the mother of magical realism. And so, yeah, there was, I was very inspired when I started writing this novel in the year 2000 or so by these magical realist texts by Midnight's Children, more so actually the Satanic Verses, Marquez, even Morrison, who is considered magical realist by some.
Well, if you go to the second grandmother, Agnes, I think, you know, well, first of all, she, what struck me about her and made me feel so bad about her is that she has such promise. She's such a complex character. And the way you described her ability at tennis, which then is no longer her ability, but again, like Argus, and as you've said, you know, there's aspects of her, because she's blind, that others perceive as having eyes all over her body, which is, which is the second grandmother who has these strange characteristics. You know, and it's funny, when you're beginning reading the book, you don't expect this. That's what I like so much about magical realism. You don't expect it, and all of a sudden it just hits you.
Yeah.
Like an anvil. And so, what about Agnes? I really liked Agnes, too.
Yeah, I mean, so Agnes is a British tennis player who goes blind. And what's interesting to me about thinking about that character, you know, who I, again, wrote when I was probably 22, was how quickly the conceit of her blindness, the metaphor of her blindness, gave way to my interest in her as a person. I think we tend to write characters who are not, who don't have normal abilities, and this appears in magical realism, but it also appears in, say, Marvel, you know, in movies, you know, the disability gets kind of mystified and made mystical. And almost immediately, writing this kind of fairy tale account of how Agnes went blind and how she met the man who would become her husband, I became interested in what it felt like to be her from the inside. And so this, you know, Sibylla is very aware of her hair, right? It's part of her, but also not part of her, is one way it gets described. Its constant maintenance is, you know, is a kind of issue that comes up when she's trying to appear in new social settings, and it becomes a kind of literal natural resource that she can give. So it's both something that she has agency over, but also that she perceives. Agnes doesn't perceive the eyes all over her body. Only other people do. And that was important to me, because I didn't think that someone from the inside of blindness would mystify themselves that way, right? And so there's a kind of projection onto her of a kind of sightedness that I'm not actually sure she possesses. But I wanted to write what it would mean to, as I say, kind of be struck by such a weighty and heavy and kind of historically laden misfortune as blindness, as a young girl who really, you know, is only interested in tennis. That was all that she really had going for her. And I say at some point that, you know, she's actually quite shallow. She's very present, let's say. She's very in the moment. But that ends up being a kind of gift to her. It's a way that she can withstand this difficulty that other people might not be able to. So, yeah, I found it, you know, I've only been realizing this in retrospect as people have asked me about Agnes's blindness, is how much more it means to me as a set of experiences I wanted to explore than it means to me as a symbol.
If we go to the third grandmother, Martha, Here's the funny thing about this, is that when I was reading about the Zambian space program, that sounded like magical realism, and then I started researching it, and it actually happened, and it was exactly the way you described it, including rolling them down the hill in the 200-liter oil
barrels. Yeah.
So, did you know about that growing up, or was that something you just found?
No,
out?
And you know what's so funny about it is when I went home to learn more about Nkoloso, who is this school teacher who started a Zambian space program in the 60s, decided to join the space race with the Russians and the Americans. And I heard about him initially through a photography exhibit by Christina Demidel that someone sent to me. And there was this newspaper clipping that appeared at the beginning of the exhibit. And it was about Nkoloso. So I started digging into this and doing more research and tried to get as much as possible as I could from the newspaper archives. And then the next time I went home, I went to the actual National Archives, and I also interviewed a bunch of people. And it turns out people knew him, people had talked to him, like my mom's, you know, very close friend had spent time with him as a child. Like, Zambia is a village, as I say repeatedly. I think I even say Lusaka is a village. It's a very small country, and people knew him but they mostly thought of him as a freedom fighter. The space program was considered this kind of whim. And not that many people knew about his intentions, like whether he was serious about it or not. And so, again, there's this really interesting different perspective from the inside of a situation and from the outside of a situation. And trying to negotiate those two views of the man was really fascinating to me. But I only learned about him in 2012 or 13. And, you know, I had been writing the novel for a while. But when I learned about Martha Mwamba, who was pregnant at 16 and who was his female astronaut and who had gotten kicked out of the space program because she was pregnant, and I realized that I had a character who was pregnant and loves, you know, heartbroken in the same year, I realized that it was basically the same person. And so I decided to incorporate the story of the space program into the novel. There's a lot of aspects of the history that I uncovered in writing the book that feels like fiction, but is true. There's a lot of stranger than fiction history in this book.
I know. Using the tire swing to simulate witnesses, and also the idea of the cats, dumping the cats.
Yeah, the cats were real, which I still have no idea, like, how that was even feasible.
You could just take that and make a Netflix miniseries about the Zambian space program. It would be hilarious.
That would be great.
Well, so now let's go on to Martha and what happens to her, because this is the third aspect of magical realism. With the grandmothers.
Yeah, so Martha, when she is heartbroken and when she's kicked out of the program, she starts to cry, and she cries for hours and then for days and then for weeks, and then she basically cries for decades. And I describe what that would do to one's body, the way your eyes would start to close up and swell, and the way that your voice would get compromised by the sobbing. And I just kind of traced this slow degradation of her ability to sense the world because of this endless weeping. And the weeping then gets picked up by neighbors who decide they want to be part of the crying community as well. Martha initially rejects this, but eventually brings herself into a community of people that way. But she's considered a witch. She's also considered a miracle. You know, there's all these different ways that people perceive this particular element. So I think in all three cases, there's a kind of biological element to the magical realism rather than magical realism that's focused on, say, nature or the natural world as interested in the human body, which is also part of nature. But and I was also very interested in the borders of the body, where we interface with the world. So hair and eyes being primary sites for that.
So this is somewhat puerile of me, I think, but when I was reading about Martha, when I was reading about this life that she had, it reminds me of when I was depressed. And the worst thing you can say is when someone looks at you and says, "Why can't you just be happy?" And I was thinking of her, "Why don't you just get over it?" You know.
Yeah.
There's part of me that just thought, "Come on, you know, get over it. You can still move on." But then, you know, then it hit me that this was something else you were actually writing about. And then when you intersect all three of these grandmothers, like you said, it does deal with the borders of the body, which is not what, say, Marquez might do when there's 20 Aurelios in the book. You know, it's a completely different thing. And then, you know, in the reviews, the book has been called picaresque, surreal, ironic. I can appreciate the reasons for those labels, but I don't particularly ascribe to them. So if you were... If you were characterizing the novel in writing a review, which you have, what would you say the tone of this novel is, especially given your gloss of your work in literary criticism?
The tone?
Yeah, the tone. Because maybe that's the wrong word. I don't know.
No. That's right. But I think I would. I don't know. I don't think surreal is correct. I think it's picaresque in parts.
Why?
There's a kind of adventure, rambling quality to, say, Percy's section, to, say, you know, when Jacob first leaves the compound. There's little elements of the picaresque here and there, but I wouldn't describe it as that all the way through. I do think that there's irony, and I think there's a specific flavor of irony which I've tried to capture before by reference to something a Zambian artist said to me once. He was talking about taking some Zambian paintings that were political satire to another African country, and he did a PowerPoint presentation, and he showed these paintings, and they didn't get it. They're like, why is it satire? Like, what makes it satirical? And he said, you know, in Zambia, our sense of irony is very subtle. We don't have a yes and a no. We have two yeses, and one of them means no. And that's always struck me as a really good way of explaining the doubleness of feeling that I want in the book, which is, as you say, this kind of sense of earnestness where you take these characters seriously and you feel for them, but also a sense of distance and also of irony rendered largely through form rather than through a kind of ironic detachment from my characters. Like, I'm not sarcastic about my characters. I don't like reading books where the author is clearly disdainful of their characters or is making fun of them. But I do think that the formal manipulations that I do, like taking heartbreak and showing you what it would look like if you intensify that over the course of decades, and the kind of pragmatic things that would come up, like how do you see if your eyelashes have sewn your eyes shut, you know, things like that, where there's a kind of irony that's emerging through the language and the form. And part of that is because I'm playing a lot with the kinds of expectations people have about African literature. So the idea that Martha is Mama Africa crying for her children is broached and dismissed because she is, in fact, crying for a broken heart, and she, in fact, abandons her child, right? So there's a kind of parodic tone in the name of subverting the expectations or the conventions that currently exist in the zeitgeist about what kind of literature is coming out of the continent. So I think irony would be the only word, but it is a specific kind of irony.
The most ironic thing in my life is that I've never been able to define irony.
It's very hard. I mean, Alanis really did a try. She made an effort, but it's not.
No, Alanis Morissette's, I have to turn that song off immediately. I can go back to the Greek definition of irony, like there's three guys at a table, and two guys know what's happening with the third guy, and the third guy doesn't know what's happening to himself.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I can get that. But after
that's
that,
dramatic irony, right? That's,
yeah,
which is a slightly different, again, from the irony of, say, a pun, right, which has this, like, double meaning, right? So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it's like, you know, the idea of, you know, you hate it, you know, what she does, you know, you hate it to fly, you were scared of flying, and then you get on a plane and it crashes, you know. That's not irony.
Right, right.
It's a coincidence. And
right.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have a real deficit in understanding the nuances of irony right now, I think, in the world, because there's this deathly fear of blurring the line between truth and fiction, regardless of whether it's in the name of humor or in the name of manipulation or in the, you know, there's this kind of idea that we must hold to fact and truth because it's being eaten away all around us cynically. But to me, only by being able to manipulate irony can we actually fight against that cynical use of it.
Right.
Because the thing about it is, you know, a lot of the lies and deceit and cynical manipulations of irony around us is that they're not actually aesthetically beautiful or funny. They're actually ugly and often quite boring. So I don't know. I'm a big fan of even if we don't know what irony is, continuing to explore what it is, in the same way that, you know, in my academic work, I was interested in exploring the multiple ways that a book can be uncertain instead of just deciding whether uncertainty was good or bad.
Yeah, I was just thinking that about your book. But, you know, it's you know, kind of... if you look at your book and the idea of... Well, first of all, when I was writing... It took me a long time to realize that you're allowed to lie, you know?
Yeah.
Because I felt, you know, it feels like if you're a stand-up comedian and you do the same routine each night, I always felt that was really bad. But then I didn't regard the fact that you have a different audience each night.
Mm.
But it bothered me that you would be saying the same thing over and over, like a politician.
Right.
A stump speech. But going back to your book... you know, you discuss the works of Thomas Pynchon, Bret Easton Ellis, Jonathan Foer, who I interviewed once. So after writing the novel and this idea of ethics and taking the reader someplace where he's got to hold two competing ideas in his head, for example, do you think you can throw yourself into the mix of the authors that you discussed in that book?
I think, you know, I break the book, that book into three different structures that produce uncertainty. Repetition, like when you're reading Beckett and something gets repeated so many times that you don't know if it's even happened. I talk about mutual exclusion, which is basically like either the person is crazy or there are really ghosts, either, you know, Oedipus is paranoid or there really is a Tristero. And then I talk about multiplicity, which is the Rashomon effect that I think many of your listeners will be familiar with, where you have multiple competing explanations for the same set of events, like witnesses on a stand testifying about what they saw of a crime. And I would say that of those three structures, my book fits more into multiplicity than anything else. There are some moments of mutual exclusion. You know, either Agnes is covered with little eyes or she isn't, but that's really, again, dependent on the viewer, right? Only certain people see that in her, and she doesn't see that, obviously, in herself or even feel it. So, and I think that the ends to which I put that uncertainty are very different than those in, say, Pynchon or, say, A Beautiful Mind, where you really are kind of have two competing views of the world. Those are sort of very small moments. I think the larger structure that we started our conversation today with, which is having multiple characters, being with them for some time, understanding that their view of the world is different, understanding their view of each other and of certain questions about politics and ethics, how to live, are different from each other. I think that's the closest to a kind of uncertainty. But there's, you know, there's very, I would say it's like uncertainty light, because I can imagine, and in fact I've written works that are much more interested in pushing that uncertainty further, leaving the reader really not knowing what happened or whether someone exists or not. And I don't really do that in the book. I'm more interested in presenting a kind of like multifaceted view, seeing in the round, as Ian Forster put it.
Well, you know, it's funny because I always, many times I ask an author, and my brother gets mad about this, but my brother likes books that end, you put everything in a box and then you wrap it up and then you tie it with a bow and that's mm-hmm. the end and you know exactly what's happened, as opposed to the books I like, which at the end you got to go, huh, now, oh, did I get that, or what are they going to do now? I prefer those right. much better. And that's like kind of like Sybilla's hair. It just kind of, as you said, it just blows up into this sphere around her body and you don't really know. There's this, like the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty or something like that.
Right.
And so I like the ones that go off like that. But what you were just saying is it doesn't apply really to the ending. It applies to the entire book. And I guess I'm not smart enough to understand in the book on criticism that it's the entire book that creates this mm-hmm. uncertainty. And the closest I can get is the idea of, which doesn't happen in our society at all, is holding two competing ideas in your head at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that I changed the word types from William Empson's seven types of ambiguity to the word mode
right.
is because I wanted to give the sense of something that takes place over time. And so that's why my book is about novels. It's not about shorter forms. It's about this kind of process where the uncertainty has, you know, certain moments where you believe one thing and then you believe something else, and then those things come into conflict. And then there is also this kind of cumulative sense when you put the book down that you're really not sure what happened or what's going to lead off of the page. So it is multiple different, I think, time scales when you're thinking about a mode of uncertainty. I think in my book, because there's some uncertainty along the way about how these three families intersect, and you know, the three grandmothers sections, they're not really interacting with each other except obliquely through minor characters. And then by the end, you have a love triangle between the descendants of the three families. So you're in the tightest possible relation that you can imagine. And there is some uncertainty there in terms of the paternity of the child that the female granddaughter, Nyla, is carrying at the end of the novel. But again, that uncertainty isn't one that I was trying to like really dig into epistemological or philosophical questions. It was just an uncertainty about who is the father of her child that I had and that I wanted to maintain. I think like you, I prefer not knowing entirely where something is going to go. I like the idea that the novel is going to kind of bleed into the future.
Yeah, and into the reader's future, which goes to, again, which I don't understand, why does literary uncertainty, why is it crucial to ethics, because it pushes you beyond the limits of your specific experience? I don't understand that. What does that mean?
So there are some literary critics that believe that literary uncertainty as such is a positive ethical thing, that it, you know, subverts our beliefs about the world. It makes us think, it makes us engage with other characters as people, and it makes us more considerate of how we have to negotiate with other people in our real lives, and so on and so forth. I actually don't believe that. The word ethical, like the word moral, has the unfortunate connotation that it's always positive. But ethics is actually a neutral realm of study, right? It's the study of how we ought to be, good and bad. And so for me, the different ways that books can be uncertain have different ethical implications. I don't necessarily think that they are better for us. I don't even believe that reading makes us better people. I'm not of that school at all. I just wrote an essay about what I call the banality of empathy, that is very much railing against this current idea we have that reading books makes us better people, that it makes us more empathic people. And so it's, for me, it's that it has ethical implications, not that it has necessarily positive or salutary effects.
Okay. That's interesting, especially since I own an independent bookstore.
Well, you know, not like I don't write books in order to be a better person. You know what I mean? It's your job. And you can, there are other things in selling books than just trying to make other people better people, right? There's reading,
yeah.
You know.
But look at a bookstore, and this is why I have a bookstore. I mean, Amazon can give you all the recommendations it wants based on what you've read in the past. But if you go into a bookstore and you're looking for a specific book and you climb my book ladder and you see the book you want, but you also see the book on the left and you also see the book on the right, and one of those books might change your life, which doesn't necessarily go against what you're saying, but I think it's the change, the way it changes you, whether it's Crime and Punishment or Gravity's Rainbow. It's going to change your life. I mean, it is. That's just the way it is.
Yeah. But I think that's why I say it has ethical implications, but it doesn't necessarily change your life for the better. There's some books that ruin people's lives.
Name one.
I mean, The Catcher in the Rye, right? Wasn't that cited by multiple people as being an inspiration for murdering people?
Yeah, that's what someone told me when I was like 16, I told some school teacher, she asked me what I was reading, and I said, I'm reading Catcher in the Rye, and she goes, oh, everybody reads that. All kids your age read that. And I was.
But if you think about, you know, American Psycho was cited in the Duke lacrosse team's emails to each other about raping a person. There's, you know, I'm sure the Marquis de Sade's books have not been used in entirely positive fashion. If you even just look at, you know, films, The Birth of a Nation, you know, entire realms of art can't be tasked with.
Well, you have to be intelligent.
Morally good.
You have to be intelligent enough to parse that. But look at first person shooter video games, like this new one, Fortnite, that I don't understand anything about. You could say the same thing about those. I mean,
you could, but you could also say, and some people do say, that at least if they're playing games, they're not doing it in real life. You know, we just don't actually know how different texts are going to affect different people. And all I'm saying is that to change one's life with literature or art is obviously very true. Whether it's for good or for bad isn't something I think that we can, I don't even think the author can predict.
No, I don't think so either. And I'm kind of being flippant about the whole thing just because of the bookstore deal. And I just realized something else. We're trying to sell your book, and nothing we're talking about is going to sell your book.
Well, I will say, you know, One way that this has been of interest to me recently is that I wrote an article for the Times Book Review about science fiction coming true.
Oh, cool.
Because, as you know, we've talked about the magical realist parts of the book, but the last third of the novel is set in the near future and includes three sci-fi elements, an HIV/AIDS vaccine in the making, micro drones that are the size of mosquitoes, and these beads that are chipped into our hands that are basically like literal Palm Pilots. They're smartphones built into your hand. And all three of those have seen advances in real science, in the real world, that uncannily echo my novel. So the CRISPR babies in China, which that news came out in the fall, I think, right after I had submitted my final manuscript. The mechanism that they used to genetically modify these twins is the same mechanism I describe in my novel. And they even said, the scientists in China said that the aim was to create an HIV/AIDS vaccine because these two little girls, their father is HIV positive. We were trying to make them resistant to HIV. That's the change they made. And it's the same exact scientific mechanism in my book. So that's just one example. But that's a huge moral quandary for science fiction writers, right?
Exactly.
What if you give people bad ideas? you know, obviously I was following the research that was already ongoing, but there are people who, you know, invent dystopian realities in their novels that then proceed to come true. And so is our responsibility then not to write them? Is our responsibility not to warn society of the possible negative effects that might come true? It's a really difficult question. So that's, I think that's one of the ways that I think the absolute lack of agency that even writers have about how their ideas or how their novels will, as you say, change lives, has become very manifest to me recently.
Yeah, it's like when I read William Gibson's Neuromancer like 30 years ago.
Yeah.
It was like, wow, this is... And now all that he wrote, we're way beyond everything he wrote. And it's just, how could I have possibly known that that would happen? That's why it's so hard to write science fiction now. You know, it's like everything under the sun. But...
Yeah, I mean, I think if you set... that's not even true. I was about to say, if you set your science fiction in kind of soap opera or space opera land, you know, where you're in outer space in these big ships, but, you know, didn't Jeff Bezos essentially just say that that's his next move?
Right.
So it's just, there's no, I think this is one of the, we talk about this all the time with nonfiction. There's a responsibility to reality. There's a responsibility to other human beings when you're writing nonfiction. I think with fiction, it seems more tenuous because it's just stories. But as you and I both know, stories really do deeply impact our lives. And I think that there are some books that, you know, even over time, they can come to mean something entirely different. And sometimes that's for the good. You know, I think the way, for example, that Moby Dick is now very obviously to us a queer text that we can celebrate in that mode, despite or maybe because of what Melville intended. But I think that there's, you know, books can touch lives across centuries. I just try to hold on to the hope that touching of life will be positive and not be perverted or turned into something negative. But it's really not, I mean, I guess this answers one of your other single questions. I don't know if it's really up to us.
You should write a science fiction book where they actually do throw, where Elon Musk actually does throw cats out when they're about to land.
I mean, it would be pretty incredible if that's the upshot of Enclosa's space project. I mean, he very much saw himself in relation to past generations and future generations. He's a dreamer up until the very end. His very last interview, he was still talking about going to Mars.
So. And the thing about, look at Elon Musk. He makes his landing ship, "Of course I still love you, just follow instructions." You know, he takes it from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And
right.
It's amazing how he does that and gets away with it. I mean, it's really funny and literary in a sense. It is literary.
I mean, there are companies now that are hiring. I talk about this in the Times article, that are hiring world builders to take an invention and see how it would actually manifest. They're called future casters or world builders. It's very much like a co-optation of narrative, you know, technique for business. So it's not, I mean, capitalism is very good at swallowing everything, so it's not surprising.
Yeah, look at Amazon.
Right. And it used to be a little bookstore, right?
Exactly. It's the bane of my existence.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it was good because you actually briefly did touch back on your book in the third section. But I didn't want to bring up the third section because I thought it would all be spoilers, so I was scared to say.
Oh, no.
Okay.
It's very hard to spoil this book, I've learned.
Hey, so what are the mosquitoes like in Zambia? Are they bad?
Yeah, they're terrible. I mean, so the difference between mosquitoes at home and in America, I've learned, is that At home, they are loud, and you don't feel them bite until the next day you're covered in bites. And so they're very, very annoying, but they're very subtle in their touch, whereas the mosquitoes here, I don't hear them that much, but when I feel a mosquito bite me, I feel it. So I don't know. I don't know what's up with their different tactics, their different approaches. But yeah, I mean, it's also, the talk about, you know, literature changing your life. I'm superstitious enough to imagine that I have now called upon myself swarms of mosquitoes whenever I go home because of writing about them. I'm sure they've had conferences to organize against me at this point.
Yeah, they do tend to. Well, my ex-wife used to say that if you have sweet skin, the mosquitoes come after you. And I think
this is what they say, sweet skin. Yeah.
But going back to the book before we end this interview, what made you decide to use this Greek chorus of a swarm of mosquitoes? How did you decide that?
So I've been asked that so many times, and I wish I had an answer for how I came up with it. I remember where I was when I came up with it, and I remember all of the different aspects of the book lighting up in my brain like a little constellation, like, oh yes, and I'm interested in flying things, and I'm interested in blood and disease, and I'm interested in you know, this question of error, which haunts my academic work as well. So I knew what they would all bring together, but I can't quite put my finger on why. It wasn't like a mosquito bit me and I thought, oh yes. But I will say, the voice of the mosquitoes, like from the opening part of the book, the very first page of the book, I wrote about David Livingstone. I wrote a long time ago, and it always had this kind of grandiose voice, and it was always interested in history, in entomology, in etymology. There's always this kind of their tone or their range of interest was always there, but I didn't know who that voice belonged to. For a while, I thought it belonged to Nyla's eventual son. Mm-hmm. But figuring out his personality in the future, figuring out, you know, his context and writing all of the things that would surround him, felt like it just didn't feel available to me, especially because, as I said, I didn't want to know who his father was, or even how he'd come up. So I ended up having this voice, but not knowing who it belonged to. And then the swarm kind of came and ventriloquized it for me.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about the readers. Well, I've been talking about the reader's uncertainty. And the first section, I didn't know. And maybe you meant to do this. I didn't know who is this. Who's telling?
Yeah, there's no indication until the second section.
Yeah, so I didn't. I knew something was going on, and I knew there was. And that's when I first got this science fiction idea in my head, but I didn't know who it was. It was like, okay, how do they know, and why are they telling me this? But then you knew, and then it was kind of cool. It was cool in the beginning, but it was even cooler.
Thanks.
Okay, so we're ending because we're actually talking about the book. It's a good time to stop.
Okay.
Instead of literary criticism. We've been talking for an hour. So anyway, yeah, thanks so much for being here. If you ever get around to Philadelphia, I would love to have you come out to the bookstore. Your book is on the front table, and it's doing very well.
Thanks. And, that would be great.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I love Philly, so next time I'm in town, I'll stop by.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. Bye. Have a good one.
So we were talking with Namwali Sirpel. Her book is called The Old Drift. And it's really cool because, just like her literary criticism book, you don't know where you are until you get there. I mean, there's lots of stuff that's kind of confusing, but it's magical, it's science fiction-y, but it basically is a history of Zambia. And we didn't get to talk too much about the history of Zambia, but it does inform you with so much information. If you put it that way, it does give you so much information about the country that you probably don't know about, and it gives you, just like she talks about in her literary criticism book, it pushes you to the edge, and then you have to kind of figure out your own ethics, and you have to figure out your own meaning of the book, and then you have to figure out, after you're done, well, what does this actually mean? How can I carry this with me? And whenever I read a good book, I always remember the names, and I remember the names here, and Agnes and Sabella and Martha. So in any event, we got a lot of good stuff coming up. Upcoming authors include Laura Ancampora, who we talked about, who I interviewed earlier. Her novel is called The Paper Wasp. And Damien Barr will join us to discuss his latest novel, You Will Be Safe Here. So for a complete schedule of everybody, visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com or simply download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic. Thanks as always for being here, and we hope we'll see you again next week on The Avid Reader.